Hello, and welcome to the very first episode of The Dark Dive, the podcast that delves into the depths of the dark web. My name is Aidan Murphy, and I'll be your host as each episode we're going to take a look at different aspects of the dark web. In the podcast feed, you can already find all of the episodes from the series. This includes deep dives into different areas of the dark web, including hacking forums, illegal marketplaces, and ransomware leak sites. But in this episode, we're going to begin at the start, at the very beginning, and define exactly what the dark web is and how it works. While it's a term you may be familiar with, there are a lot of misconceptions about the dark web. We're going to tackle some of those in this episode. And to do that, I'm joined by two of the biggest brains in the business. Dr. Gareth Owenson, renowned academic of internet anonymizing technologies, and now CTO and co-founder of Searchlight Cyber. Hello, Gareth.
Hi, Aidan.
And cybersecurity expert Jim Simpson, Director of Threat Intelligence at Searchlight Cyber. Hey, Jim.
You're all right, dude. I like Gareth's intro better, to be honest. Not that I'm getting jealous or anything.
All right. Well, I'm going to give you a chance to do your own. So before we jump in, can I ask each of you to just give a quick overview of yourselves to our listeners? We'll start with you, Gareth.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gareth Owenson. I'm the CTO, Chief Technology Officer, and one of the founders at Searchlight Cyber. Before I started Searchlight, I was an academic working in the field of cryptography, dark webs, cryptocurrencies. I've been doing that for about 10 to 15 years, published some of the most influential papers in the realms of dark webs, really focused on trying to help the likes of law enforcement uncover some of the crime which is taking place and ultimately go on and investigate those crimes. And one of the reasons why I wanted to set up a company called Searchlight is because when we were working with law enforcement, they had a problem with investigating crimes on the dark web, but they didn't really know how to. And what they really wanted was a tool set which we could put in front of them that would help them solve the crimes. And so that's where Searchlight came from, is really to build that set of tools so that law enforcement can investigate people who believe they can act with impunity on the dark web and ultimately put them behind bars. And we've been running now for about 6 years and have very much been helping government and law enforcement do that over that time.
Brilliant. Thanks, Gareth. And Jim, do you mind just giving a very quick introduction to yourself?
Yeah, I'm Jim Simpson. I'm the Director of Threat Intelligence at Searchlight Cyber. I'm also a SANS certified instructor candidate on the Forensics 578 course, which is the CTI course that SANS offer. I don't have any law enforcement background, so I've come from the enterprise side of things. Previous to this, I worked at BlackBerry Silence as the Director of Threat Intel over there. Before that, I was in industry helping different organizations protect themselves, doing SOC work and a bit of IR work, incident response work. At Searchlight, we head up the collection side of things. We try and identify where we want to get collection from, which is going to help both our enterprise and our law enforcement customers, as well as once that data has been collected, we do some reports and we work with that data to make sure that you can get some good stuff out of it.
Brilliant. Well, thanks, Jim. I'm actually going to stick with you because before we get into, I guess, the topic of the podcast of how the dark web works, and we're going to rely on Gareth as the foremost expert to talk us through. I guess wanted to get your perspective on what the dark web means to cybersecurity, or the cybersecurity community. How relevant is it to that community? How much of an impact does it have on the day to day?
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about like the different services and everything that's offered on the dark web throughout the rest of this podcast, I think. But from a security understanding perspective, you want to know where your threats are going to come from, right? And as we've seen the landscape grow, we've seen specialization in different areas within the sort of criminal underworld or the ecosystem, whatever fancy name you want to give it, where the bad guys operate. And one side of that is that initial access side. People are selling access to companies, or people's credentials might have been compromised and they might be for sale on either an auto shop or marketplace, which is kind of what we're looking at. From the security defender's perspective, so if I'm defending myself from whatever's happening out there, those can be really early signals that something's going wrong in your environment and can actually help you stop further attacks. If someone's selling initial access to your environment, you have suffered a breach at that point, you are compromised, but the whole point of their access is to sell their access on to someone else who's going to do something else, which is much worse. There's a bit of signal there that you can use to start hunting throughout your environment to try and find what might have been sold and what access might be present to stop whatever the follow-on actions are. From a law enforcement perspective, like Gareth was talking about earlier, we need to make sure that we have a record of everything that's going on. A lot of the ways in which people end up getting caught is OPSEC failures from early days when they're starting out. And if you don't have that historic record of what's happened and who said what and what bits of data they've given away, you're going to struggle to get back to who they are as a person. And yeah, that's why this technology, like the stuff that Searchlight offers, gives you that historical view on things. If you're just relying on the dark web to be there when you want to go back to it, you're not in control of it. You might be reliant on a piece of data that someone's taken down. If someone else has taken a copy of that before it's taken down, then yeah, that's where you need to go to see what it was, see the history. It's like a way back machine for the dark web.
And out of interest, because I don't think I've ever asked you, and this seems like a good time, as someone I'm taking is completely representative of the cybersecurity community as a whole, how much did you know about the dark web before you came to Searchlight?
That's a good question. So I kind of knew what it was. Working from the malware side of things before, when I was at BlackBerry, we used the dark web to try and find out who was selling what. We were way more focused on malware back then than anything else. So we were looking for strings. We were looking for people selling different bits of code and trying to get hold of that code early on to make sure that, one, we were defending against it, and two, where it was being used and see if we were seeing it in any of our environments. So from a research perspective, I'd used it, but it wasn't like, I didn't understand necessarily how it works. It was only when I started talking to Dr. Big Brain, that's now going to be my nickname for it, that I got a bit more of an idea of where it works and the uses for it.
Brilliantly set up. So Gareth, we'll turn to you then. So it's a really obvious question, but I don't think it's actually an obvious answer for a lot of listeners. So I guess I'll ask you, what exactly are we talking about when we say the dark web?
Yeah, I mean, it's somewhat of a poorly defined term. You know, it's one of those things that kind of like you know it when you see it. But typically, I think when people have tried to come up with a definition for it, what they've called it is an encrypted part of the internet that requires special software to access, I think, is the textbook definition. What practically that means is it's normally somewhere on the internet where you download some specialist software, and that software is really designed to hide your identity. And then you browse web pages without those websites knowing where you are or who you are. And so naturally, when you introduce forms of anonymity to people, you know, groups of people, that is, often lots of crimes start to emerge because people think they can act without any kind of consequences. And so typically, when you look at dark webs, that's what happens. It grants them some form of anonymity by downloading the specialist software. And then it's called the dark web because you end up with this concentration of crimes taking place in that particular forum, and it's really stemming from the fact that there is this anonymity in the first place.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I mentioned misconceptions at the beginning, and I do think one that, you know, I've seen even in cybersecurity press is just that the dark web describes all kind of bad things that happen on the internet, but from what you're saying, it's a specific area that is purposefully obfuscated or hidden, whichever word you want to use.
Yeah, I mean, there are several different dark webs, and they all behave very slightly differently. But from a user point of view, normally it's, you know, additional piece of software you download, but it behaves like a web browser. You're browsing web pages, but your activity of browsing gives you some form of anonymity while you're browsing those pages. And as you said, you know, like, bad stuff does happen on the dark web. In fact, it makes up the majority of activity which takes place on dark webs. There are so-called good uses for anonymity. And so you do see some of those activities on the dark web, but unfortunately, they're generally outweighed quite significantly by the sort of negative criminal activity which takes place. But, you know, examples of good uses would be, you know, if you're in China, for example, and you want to access information which is blocked by the Chinese government through censorship, then you could use a dark web tool to bypass that censorship and see that information. Or if you're an activist in China wanting to publish something about the Chinese government, obviously it's a very dangerous activity. You can publish something on a dark web, and the idea is the dark web makes it difficult to know where that information is located, and so therefore makes it difficult for the authorities to locate the publisher of that information. And that's I guess kind of the textbook example of what dark webs are designed for. It's just an unfortunate fact of reality that when you give, you know, large groups of people anonymity, crime tends to emerge, either because it attracts those kinds of people or because people are less, they fear the consequences less, and I suspect it's probably a bit of both.
I'm sure a sociologist listening has very strong opinions, but
I'm sure, not my field. Yeah.
Before we get into the bad use cases, then, one thing I just wanted to ask about, because I do think it helps clear things up in people's mind, is
how does the dark web differ from what we call the deep web and the clear web, which are also phrases you hear people throw around quite a lot? Do you kind of have a definition of those that can help distinguish the dark web?
Yeah, sure. This is a little bit more delineated. So the clear web really is any kind of website that you would go to in your Chrome browser that's out on the public internet. So, you know, Facebook's on the clear web, Twitter's on the clear web, your bank's on the clear web, New York Times, BBC, etc. And you can all access those on your phone, on your desktop computers, without any kind of specialist software. And they're designed to be accessed by people, you know, without any kind of restriction. So that's generally what is understood as the clear web. There is some overlap between the clear web and the so-called deep web, because the deep web, in its strictest definition, is really any website which isn't indexed by Google. What practically that means is it's websites like, for example, closed forums that require a login page to get into the forum. Google can't index it because Google doesn't have a login for it. So that's technically part of the deep web. And also a company intranet, for example, it's only accessible by the employees inside the company network. It's still a web page. It's still accessed through Chrome or Firefox. But because Google can't get to it because it's behind that company firewall, that's technically part of the deep web. And then also you would see things like, you know, control systems. So things like, you know, industrial control systems, like CCTV cameras, you know, network file sharing devices, those sorts of things. You know, they've all got web pages to access them, but they're not designed for public consumption. They're not designed to be indexed by Google. And so that part of the so-called deep web, as it were. And then the dark web is really kind of an extension of the deep web, but you need a specialist kind of software to access it. So on the deep web, typically using Chrome or Firefox, no specialist software to access those sites. With the dark web, you are using specialist software. That specialist software is really giving you the anonymity to access those sites. In many cases, though, you know, dark web software is just modified versions of Firefox or Chrome to add that anonymity in it. So the user experience doesn't really differ from the deep web or the clear web, other than the fact you're getting this anonymity in it. And because these dark web websites, you know, they're somewhat more bandwidth constrained, they tend to look a little bit more like websites out of the 1990s than what you'd see out of the 2020s nowadays. And that's just because they've got less bandwidth to transfer that data. Although that's been changing a lot over the last few years as dark webs have got faster. They're starting to look a little bit more modern nowadays than they used to.
Jim, so just jumping in, I guess, or referring back to what you were discussing at the beginning. So from your point of view, you see these as sources of intelligence. So I guess the difference between the clear web, the deep web, the dark web, I'm sure there's a lot of criminal intelligence on the clear web and the deep web as well, but the dark web has those two components, I guess, of anonymity, which means that there's more criminal activity. It also makes it harder to collect from. Is that fair to say?
The bandwidth constraints obviously make it trickier. There's a lot of crossover between the deep web type of sources, where Gareth was talking about, where you need that access to get into those pages in order to go and have a look what's going on. It's the same idea on the majority of the dark web sites. You still need to make sure you have an account on these sites in order to go and have a look at that side of things. And I think the dark web, like Gareth said, is the anonymity side of things. It just means people have this perception that they can go on there and say whatever they want and do whatever they want. And for the most part, yeah, they take advantage of that. It's the clues they leave behind that are useful for law enforcement. It's the products that they offer that are useful for enterprise defenders. And it's that signal that we're trying to take out of the whole mess of stuff that's going on these marketplaces, forums, all that kind of thing.
That's just so interestingly, like, it's sometimes easier to collect from the dark web than it is from the clear web. You know, because a lot of the technology on dark webs is really sort of 10, 20 years old as far as trying to defeat people crawling those sites. If you go on the clear web, people are using these modern technologies like Cloudflare, where they've got very sophisticated and complicated captures. Those things make it very difficult to collect from those sites. When you look at the dark web, they're often building their own captures. They can't use Cloudflare because it's not compatible with the dark web. And so it becomes easier to collect from those sites, other than the initial technical knowledge in terms of actually accessing the site to do the collection in the first place. Once you've got that knowledge for a technical person, it's easier to collect from the dark web, bizarrely, than the clear web itself, despite it being out in the open.
It raises quite an interesting issue then, because if there are security flaws within the dark web, as you've mentioned, Gareth, why do criminals use it? Because of this belief that even if those flaws are exploited, their anonymity remains?
Yeah, I mean, the flaws I was just talking about doesn't really impact their anonymity, you know, other than the fact, you know, doesn't make who runs that site that's hosting all of that content known. It just means it's easier for us to collect the information from it than if it were on the clear web using something like Cloudflare or one of those other technologies. But dark webs, you know, like any kind of software, do have flaws in them. And dark webs are kind of like an active area of research and have been for quite some time. And the idea is a sort of perfect system that gives everyone that's using it anonymity so that no one that's observing the whole network can work out who someone is or where that site's located. But the truth is, there is no perfect dark web. Everyone's striving for this ideal where if you had this global surveillance system run by likes of NSA and GCHQ and what have you, that could observe the internet at every single corner of it, a dark web ideally would still be able to protect the people using it in the place of an adversary like that. But the reality is none of the modern dark webs protect people when you have a very powerful adversary who can observe the internet all over the world and see where traffic's being routed through. And that's been known about, you know, since the inception of dark webs. But what the field has done, it's got better at making it harder and harder for those agencies to observe and identify people on dark webs, but it's still very much possible, you know, for an adequately resourced attacker or adversary. It's just that they've made it harder. Now, most, you know, if you're on the dark web selling drugs, for example, you know, the NSA is not coming after you because it's just not that bad. You know, if you're engaged in terrorist activity, then perhaps you're slightly more at risk. So if you're someone, you know, peddling traditional crimes, you know, your adversary is law enforcement, really, and law enforcement are far less resourced than the likes of the NSA or GCHQ, who have global surveillance systems that could break those dark webs. So whilst dark webs are not, you know, don't provide perfect security, they do make it harder to investigate, and it is challenging to identify people and sites and where they're located. It's not impossible, it is challenging. However, if you contrast that with being on the clear web, you know, where it's really quite straightforward to identify who someone is or where they're located, it's really an additional barrier of security against, you know, law enforcement working out who or where you are. It doesn't protect absolutely. It just makes it harder, and so you're less likely to get caught, or it means that law enforcement have to focus on, you know, the high risk offenders and perhaps leave the people at the lower end of the food chain behind because they just don't have the resource to go after them, because it takes more resource to do that investigation. So, you know, I mean, not that I'm advertising it, but you know, there clearly is an advantage to using the dark web for criminals, but it's not a license to act with absolute impunity and zero consequences, because at some point you are likely to get caught if you make a big enough noise.
And we should say it's part of our mission to make it easier for law enforcement to do that job, so we're definitely not advocating it. So at this point, I think it's time to take a forensic look at one of these dark webs. I noticed, Gareth, that you're being very technically correct in saying dark webs. The most popular dark web is Tor. Would you mind giving us the kind of run through of what Tor is?
Yeah, so you're right. When most people say dark web, what they really mean is Tor. And Tor is one of the dark webs. There are, you know, probably 100 or more other dark webs, but there's a small number of them which are the most popular. But by far and ahead, the most popular is Tor. Now, most dark webs, including Tor, work by bouncing your traffic around the world. So let's say I want to go to the New York Times' website. Ordinarily, me in the UK would connect directly with the New York Times, request the web page, and then get the page results back and see the contents in my browser. When you add something like Tor in the mix, what actually happens is my traffic starts in the UK, but it gets bounced around a collection of relays around the world. And these will be based in countries all over the world. And my computer would pick a random set of three to bounce it through. And so if anyone's observing my internet connection, all they see is me connecting to the Tor network. They don't see what I'm doing on the Tor network. That traffic is then bounced all around the world, perhaps through three different countries, and then comes out the final place and then goes directly to the New York Times. The only thing the New York Times sees is that very last point wherever my traffic happened to exit the Tor network from. All my ISP sees is me connecting to a dark web. So I get both privacy and anonymity. Privacy meaning you don't know what I'm doing, and anonymity meaning you don't know who I am, but I get them at slightly different points. My ISP knows who I am, but they don't know what I'm doing, so I have privacy from my ISP. The New York Times knows what I'm doing. You know, I'm coming to their site and visiting a particular web page, but they don't know who I am, so I get anonymity. And then in the middle of that connection, you know, all the traffic is encrypted, so no one knows who I am or indeed what I'm doing. So Tor gives you both of those things, but just at different points in the network. Now, the dark web is an extension of that basic Tor network, and it gives you the ability to host a website anonymously on top of this idea of bouncing traffic around the network. I won't go into precisely how it works, because it's quite complicated how it achieves it. But the idea is that if someone wants to host a website, you know, you set up your website and you connect into the Tor network and you kind of advertise it as being available, and then people can connect to you, but by bouncing traffic through these relays all the way around the world before it comes to your site. So the advantage of this over the former example is that you actually don't know where the site's being hosted, and the site doesn't know where the user is either. And so both parties end up being anonymous to each other. And so it means you can host a website, you can do whatever you want, and it should be, in theory, impossible for law enforcement to work out where that site is being hosted, and therefore they can't take that site down, or they can't identify you and arrest you. That's the basic concept behind a dark web.
And those sites are called onions or hidden services. And we should say that Tor stands for the onion router.
That's correct. Yeah. So Tor is an acronym which stands for the onion router, which is run by a not-for-profit project called the Tor Project. It was a project originally coming out of DARPA in the US, and now has been grown into a big open source project by a couple of MIT ex-graduates that set up this Tor Project non-profit. The original concept behind it was that the US government wanted the ability for spies abroad to send messages back to their homeland without knowing who they are. But the problem is, if you see someone if you're a spy in China and you connect to, a dark web node, for example, like the Chinese government can see you connecting to a dark web node. So that's pretty obvious, you're a spy. The extension to that is then if you get lots of people to use the dark web for innocent reasons, then the fact that you're connecting to a Tor node is no longer a problem, right? Because you could be using it for one of those innocent reasons. And so that's the original concept behind how Tor came to fruition.
That makes sense. And it's not the only dark web. So there are others, I2P, ZeroNet. But why has Tor remained so dominant? Is it about ease of use? Is it about the time it's been around, reputation? Is there a contributing factor?
Yeah, so I2P and Tor have been around about similar amounts of time. And there are dark webs that even predate Tor. But the thing that Tor, I want to say innovated on, but they were really focused on, was making it to be easy to use. And if you want to get onto the dark web today, you can go onto their website, you can download the Tor browser bundle, and you can be on the dark web in 3 or 4 minutes, with a web browser. You put in your onion addresses and you go directly to them. So it's very simple for people to get onto it. I wouldn't say that's the only thing that made it popular. Probably one of the main things that popularized it was in the early 2010, 2011. A guy called Ross Ulbricht figured that you could launch a drugs website on Tor and law enforcement wouldn't be able to know where the site's being hosted. Now there's this new thing called Bitcoin, which is, inverted commas, anonymous way to make payments. So now you have all of the ingredients you need to make an e-commerce site, which law enforcement can't physically get their hands on. And so he launched a drugs website that took Bitcoin as payment, the site being hosted on Tor, so you couldn't work out where he was. The payments via Bitcoin at the time, law enforcement couldn't work out where those payments were being made to. And so that site obviously thrived very quickly and started getting large numbers of users. Magazines like Wired and a few others picked up on it. And that really popularized the whole concept behind Tor and dark webs. And they just exploded in terms of popularity from that day forward. So I think it's really a combination of the ease of use and also these early use cases, which really took off and got lots of publicity in the early days. And now if you're any kind of cyber criminal, quote, worth your salt, then you'll be hosting part of your infrastructure or operations on the Tor network, probably, because it makes it harder for law enforcement.
Which drug marketplace was that, Gareth? I'm sure we have a lot of people who know all these things inside out, but
it was called Silk Road.
Silk Road. And there was a Silk Road 2 and everything, but we won't go into the history of that.
Yeah, it was a Silk Road 2, yeah, written by a British guy, but he got arrested, I think, a week or so after it got launched. So it wasn't quite as successful as the first one.
Not the most successful. Well, this brings us nicely onto the criminality on the dark web, and I'm going to come back to you, Jim. So Gareth has mentioned drugs. From a cybersecurity perspective, though, what type of criminality do we see on the dark web? What's the kind of smorgasbord that you might expect to find if you were poking around the dark web?
There's a whole bunch of stuff that you can get on there. So there's different types of markets. So like you have sort of escrow markets and auto shops. So escrow markets, you pay a balance in order to get onto the forum. Your money's held there until the sale goes through. When both parties agree, then that site will pay you back. Auto shops being like the automated version. Like you go on, you're trying to buy some credentials and yep, you've sent over your Bitcoin, here are your creds. It all just works without having any sort of negotiation or trade in the middle. But when you're on there, there's a whole bunch of stuff that you can start looking for, but you can get everything from helping develop malware. You can get FUD services. So if you have malware and you want to make sure that our malware will bypass antivirus, FUD is for fully undetectable services. You can go and buy DDoS or stressors. You can get, like I said, credentials. You can get fulls, which are not just username and password, but all sorts of financial information, dates of birth, all your secret passwords, all your questions that you have to answer to get access to Facebook. There are tools out there that just harvest this data, and then they will sell those logs on, so that if I wanted to pretend to be you and you had been victim to this, I could go on and buy, I don't know, 100 different accounts, 100 different personas, and then pretend to be you on those. Genesis was one of the biggest marketplaces that we've seen recently taken down. Genesis was kind of novel in the way that it did it, and that it didn't just offer you access to those credentials, but it would create like an emulation of that user's browser. So if they had stolen any tokens, where, like, if you think about the last time you logged on to Amazon, once you've logged on the computer, you never log into Amazon again, right? And it's because they store sort of session tokens and authentication tokens in there. Where Genesis bot would do would steal those and then create a virtual machine that you could connect to and pretend to be whoever you wanted. So that's kind of it from the like fraud side of things. But then people are selling initial access, like I talked about before. So you have this idea of initial access brokers, where these are people who specialize in getting or either exploiting vulnerabilities or getting access to certain companies. They'll then sell that onto another leg of the sort of cybercrime underworld, who will then use that access to go and do whatever they want to do. Typically, we see that manifest as ransomware, but you'll see people getting in there for exfiltration of data, IP theft. The more that the whole sort of cyber criminal ecosystem has grown, the more specialization there's been. You don't have to be able to do everything from initial access or like pivoting through a network all the way to exfiltration. If you are good at initial access, you have a scalable business at that point. The more people I can get access to, or the more networks I can pop, I can own, I can then sell that access onto other people, and that's where I'll make my money from it. It's all about how do I monetize access, and from those guys' perspective.
And the dark web, I guess, has allowed those business models to develop.
The dark web, definitely, and cryptocurrency, like Gareth mentioned earlier, has allowed these to develop, because there is this idea of anonymity, and all this type of stuff was happening before. There was just getting access to it was more difficult. I guess the dark web and the forums and the marketplaces has lowered the barrier to entry on that side of things. That's meant people can specialize and they have a common place to go to sell their wares. Whereas before, they would have to either figure out their own way to sell it. It would be in like closed little networks, which means your total market is a lot smaller. The dark web, like the onion services, the hidden services that exist on Tor, facilitated that trade in these illicit goods and services. But yeah, I mean, you can pretty much get everything you want. That's from like the cybersecurity perspective. From the law enforcement perspective, it's, yeah, guns, drugs, weapons.
Would you agree with Gareth's assertion that any cyber criminal worth their salt is using the dark web to some degree, or maybe flipping the idea on its head? Is there a certain profile of cyber criminal that we see on the dark web? Are they at the more sophisticated end? Are we talking script kiddies, state-backed actors?
I'd say everyone's represented on there. You get people on there, and it's kind of fun reading through some of the forums. You can see the different people at the different levels they're at. You get people who want to get into it, and they're there to get advice, and it's like the training room for it sort of thing. How do I do this? Anyone got a playbook on how to exploit some vulnerability? There's trade in those vulnerabilities. Some of the initial access will be used by state-backed actors. They don't want to necessarily do the initial access themselves, and the fact that they can rely on this ecosystem of things coming through means that it's easier for them to hide in plain sight. Telling the difference between state-backed actors and what would have been called script kiddies back in the day.
You could tell I was still living back in the day.
from the script kiddies is that their sophistication is increasing, and the state actors don't mind that at all, because it means that when they're on operations, it's more difficult to say, okay, is this actually state-backed, or is this just script kiddie who has learned their trade by reading all these different forums and training in that world?
Is there a term I should be using instead of?
Yeah, I'm also curious. Yeah, what is the new?
I think the idea behind script kiddies is like, oh yeah, these are kind of noddy attackers. They don't really know what they're doing. And I think the point I'm trying to make is that we say script kiddie because they might just be specialized in one area and they do rely on scripts heavily, like they rely on playbooks. But it doesn't mean that the damage they do is any less severe, right? And I think that's the difference. You sort of like say script kiddie is a derogatory term to say someone isn't well trained, but in reality they can do the same amount of damage as someone who is well trained if they have the right tools and they have the right playbooks.
In many respects, you know, the ransomware groups are kind of a professionalized script kiddie, aren't they? But they're prolific in their impact, really.
Exactly.
A national security threat for most countries nowadays, just because of the fact they're prolific, not
exactly
because they're necessarily technically competent.
Yeah, and you saw it in the Conti leaks where they leaked the playbooks, and this is how you do an attack our way, and it means that someone who has little knowledge or they can use systems or whatever, but they don't have to be extremely proficient in order to do it. Here's the playbook. If this goes wrong, do this. And I don't know. I'm just trying to make the point that you can say script kiddie, and you would be right to say script kiddie, but they still pose a genuine threat. That's the point I'm trying to make around this kid.
I mean, I think most attackers are some form of script kiddie nowadays, aren't they? You know, very few people are writing their own exploits to target companies. You know, they're downloading stuff, they're buying it, they're quickly weaponizing things that have just been released and then just being prolific in it. You know, most organizations are not going to get touched by those.
Well, it's a specialization. Yeah, you don't necessarily have the generalists who are good at every stage of it. You have the specialists in like standing up infrastructure. You have the specialists in malware development. You have the specialists who are like going through what's been exfiltrated and like reading through all that documentation. Whereas back in the day, you had to be able to do all of it, and you had to be able to do all of it well.
Yeah, well, and all these people meet on the dark web, so that's why it's such an important topic. I will say at this point that we have episodes covering some of these issues in more detail. So do check out the podcast feed for maybe some more on ransomware groups and other things. But I will turn now to you, Gareth. So that's the cybersecurity side of things, and that's a huge topic in itself. But you mentioned drugs. There is a more traditional crime element to the dark web. Could you give some sense, I guess, of the type of crime that we observe or law enforcement observe?
Crime is just crime, right? You have technology sometimes which enables crime, and dark web is just an enabler for traditional types of crime. You know, cyber crime at its base is things like fraud and those sorts of things which traditional crime has just been enabled by cyber. And so the dark web is very much just an enabler of traditional crimes. You know, the big types of activities you see on dark webs like Tor, sale of drugs gets a lot of press. There are a number of sites selling drugs, weapons, you know, hacked accounts, those sorts of things. There's child exploitation material, there's hacking and cybercrime sites, selling things that Jim alluded to, like accounts, access to companies' networks, as well as hacking tools. You know, really the plethora of stuff that you see in the real world or traditionally online, you can see on the dark web. It's just that it makes it slightly more challenging to investigate the crime when it's happening on the dark web. You know, you see people doing bomb threats, for example. You know, there was a guy out of I think MIT, who didn't want to take his exam because you know, he hadn't done his revision. So he emailed a bomb threat to his, you know, to his university using Tor, thinking, well, I'm using Tor, so they won't be able to work out who I am. So they received the bomb threat. You know, they cancelled the exam and had a partial campus evacuation as well. And then the MIT's IT team went, so we've got the email around this point. The person was probably a student. So let's see who was using Tor around that time. And lo and behold, I think there was one or two guys, and they just went knocked on their dorm room doors and asked them about it. And the guy was like, how did you know it was me? Well, we didn't, but you just admitted it. Thanks very much. So that's an example of a traditional style crime, which is just being enabled by Tor. You know, back when I was a kid, you used to do it. Well, I didn't, obviously, but people used to do it using the school payphone in the corner, you know.
It's one of these kind of dark web, or, I mean, it's a true story, but that you do get these kind of dark web myths and quite extreme. Hitmen for Hire is one that springs to mind. But
that's not a myth, that's true.
Hitmen for Hire on the dark web is true?
Yeah, absolutely it's true.
Have there been cases of successful?
Yep. Yeah, I think there was one this year in the UK, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, not so much of a myth then. What you mentioned right at the outset of the podcast that the dark web is predominantly used for criminal activity, and that's where this kind of dark concept comes from. I know it's really hard to put numbers on this, but what are we talking? You mentioned there are good use cases, you know, people in states that are under repressive regimes and privacy is important, but from your perspective, or I guess from our experience, how much of the dark web is really more about criminality than it is about positive use cases?
Yeah, so it is quite a difficult question to answer, but let me give you perhaps some examples which kind of add some color to it. If you were to look at dark web sites and just put them into categories, you know, this is a drug site, so that's criminal, or this is a human rights site, so it's positive, around 60% of dark web sites are criminal in nature in some form. And then there's a bit of a gray area where it's difficult to put some of the sites into different buckets. Of those dark web sites, those engaged in things like political style activities, like human rights, allowing people to speak out and those sorts of thing, make up around about 1% of those sites. So it's a very, very small proportion, those, I guess, sort of example use cases of dark web. But very much the majority of activity on dark websites, as I'm sort of looking at a total of dark websites, appears to be criminal in nature. When you look at users, where are users going onto the dark web, you see that the vast majority, in fact, are going to the criminally orientated sites. So they're going to the child exploitation sites, the drugs marketplaces, weapons for sale, those sorts of things. And so the bulk of them are, in fact, going to those criminal sites. They're coming to the dark web for that sort of stuff. I will just say, though, you know, it is difficult to collect accurate stats on the dark web, but that broad picture, which is paints that, is very much accurate.
That's really helpful. Thanks, Gareth. And Jim, I guess one way I look at the dark web from our perspective is that it's almost as much challenges as opportunity for cybersecurity professionals in particular. Would you mind maybe expanding on that? How do you see the dark web from a security perspective? What challenges does it put up for a defender, and what kind of opportunities are there to be grasped for somebody who wants to gather more intelligence?
There's two ways in which you can think about, like, I look at it from Intel perspective, right? So if you're looking at Intel, then you need to have collection, and collection is the data that you have that you can ask questions of. What we've been talking about so far is what has been advertised on the dark web, what's on those markets, what's on the forums, and what people are talking about. And if you have the time to go through that, there's an awful lot of information out there. There's an awful lot of data out there that you can ask to say, am I being targeted? Am I a victim? Do I see anything out there that I think relates to my company? And where the specialization that we've seen manifest over the past few years, where people are targeting more like, I'm going to be an initial access broker or whatever, at some point they have to sell those wares. And if you have decent collection on the dark web, you can see when those sales are being advertised for a lot of things. Some stuff happens behind closed doors, but a lot of it happens on the dark web. So if you have visibility into that space, then you have the ability to pick up some of these adverts quicker, see if it relates to you quicker before the follow-on actions happen. And that specialization in the mix of the dark web actually gives us more of an opportunity right there. What it also does mean is that there are more people therefore trying to do it, which means you are having maybe an awful lot more of these lower level attacks that you don't necessarily see until they pop up on the dark web. I think the other place where we can look at collection is the sort of network traffic. So if, like Gareth talked about when he talked about the dark webs earlier on, and Tor specifically, you can either route traffic via Tor in order to hit an endpoint. So if I have a externally facing piece of kit, and I don't want you to know who is attacking that piece of kit or connecting to that piece of kit, you can route that traffic via Tor. If you can see that traffic, you can say, okay, well, someone is trying to hide who they are, and they are like connecting to our VPN. And from a security perspective, that gives you an idea, okay, well, either they have access to it, we can follow on, we can go do some hunting from that perspective. If you're seeing multiple attempts to that VPN, does that mean they don't have credentials and they're trying an exploit? In which case, do I need to patch something sooner? And you can use both the traffic collection and the data collection from the sites and people who are selling their wares as like signal that means you can go do something or go act upon something, start a hunt. There's a bunch of things, tabletop exercises.
So from a security defender's perspective, Tor can almost be used as a red flag of something suspicious going on because...
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure. And it can be used, like I said, numerous different teams within the security realm. So like everything from vulnerability management all the way to incident response or threat hunting. You can use different data points to say, okay, well, we know this has happened. Like we've seen some credentials for one of our users being sold on the dark web. Okay, we know that has happened. Therefore, we take action based off that. We can see someone is advertising access to a company that looks like ours. All right, we're not 100% certain that's ours, but they've given us enough details in that advert, like they're selling RDP access with a admin user to a company that's in our vertical and their turnover is around the same as ours. Okay, we don't know for definite that we're targeted, but we can say we might be. Let's go start a hunt based off of that. And when I say a hunt, then you generate hypothesis off that saying, okay, the initial point of breach is here. What evidence would we look to see at this point? And you can go and dig in from that perspective. The traffic connecting multiple times over the same port to a VPN server. Does that mean there's an exploit in the wild that hasn't even been revealed by the company yet? There might not be a patch for it. Do we need to take other mitigations on those services to restrict it or something along those lines? There's so much you can do with it. It's kind of difficult to say, oh yeah, do this one thing if you see this, because it all depends on what the signal is you're getting. But you are getting a lot of signal from the dark web.
Guess going back to Gareth's example of the university student, even insider threat could be.
Yeah. We saw a great example when we were working on some stuff for one of the finance reports that we did. There was some dude on there blatantly saying, I'm a janitor at a bank. I have access to the server room between these hours of the day and no one's watching me. What should I do? It's like, okay, well, you can tell it was a bit of broken English, so might not be US or UK based. You could figure out a little bit around the working hours. Does that fit your pattern? Do you have anyone who's like on the janitor team coming in, like the use of words for it? And it's all these different things that you can go look for.
And Gareth, from a law enforcement perspective, I imagine the dark web is more about challenges than it is opportunities. We've discussed some of them around anonymity. For them, it's just a pain that the dark web exists.
It certainly is a problem, right? You know, law enforcement have been around a long time. New crimes happen all the time. Law enforcement, like any other industry, evolves. And the guys working in law enforcement are generally pretty smart, and they're used to getting around challenges like this. You know, you only have to look in the press to see the large numbers of people getting arrested, running dark websites or buying and selling drugs on them, to see that whilst it's frustrating for law enforcement, it's certainly not stopping them identifying and prosecuting people. I think one thing it brings to law enforcement is that, you know, there's a concentration of criminals in one place. So they're not necessarily hunting around in lots of places looking for them. But yeah, it certainly does bring challenges for them. But that said, law enforcement are pretty good at getting around these sorts of problems. And one of the nice things from a law enforcement point of view is, you know, a criminal only has to screw up once for law enforcement to get them. And so, you know, the criminals are coming on there every single day of the week, and they've got to be totally on it 100% of the time to get away with not getting caught. The second they make a mistake, there's a trace left, which law enforcement are going to immediately home in on, and that person is going to be arrested pretty quickly. So in reality, if you're a criminal, you know, many of whom maybe come into the dark web for the first time, or perhaps had a limited amount of experience on it, not necessarily know best practice, for them to operate over months or years without making a single mistake, it really is nigh on impossible. And so that leaves plenty of opportunity for law enforcement to go ahead and identify people and put them behind bars.
We have a separate episode about how they might go about doing that, so I won't go into too much depth now. But I think a question that a listener might have, or I would be screaming at my device, is why can't we just take the dark web down? Is this hive of criminality and we know who runs it, or, you know, who runs some of the bigger ones? Well, why is it still there?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great question. The reality is the Tor project at the moment is part funded by the US State Department because they believe it helps human rights and oppressive regimes. And so you've kind of got the left hand not talking to the right hand. I'm sure the FBI are not too happy that the same government is also partly funding the project. But even if, you know, the US government stopped funding the project and perhaps some of the other sponsors pulled out, I think very likely the dark web would continue in some form because it is an open source project. And it's kind of like one of those things where you let the cat out of the bag, it's impossible to put it back in again. So the dark web is kind of like that. That said, however, Tor is run by a non-profit foundation. And whilst they say outwardly that, you know, they don't control the network, really they do. And so they do have the technical ability to block criminal sites on the dark web should they wish to do so. But they have an ideological belief that, you know, they shouldn't be the censor. And who watches the watchers if they were the censor? And so they don't engage in any of that stuff, no matter how bad the crime that's taking place. And so, yes, like any technology, it's possible to restrict its usage. For anyone to conclude otherwise would be deluded. But to wipe out completely would be a challenge, simply because it's open source and anyone can download the software. You can even set up your own Tor network should you wish to do so. Should the main one get taken down and trying to attract some users to use it. So we're at a stage where we can't put it back. Some people will remember the crypto wars back in the early 1990s, where the US government tried to suppress cryptography being leaked around the world. And that was a battle that the US government ultimately lost, because it's open source code that gets leaked out. There were actually some very famous people who deliberately tried to get it on the internet for public consumption. And once it's out there, it's very difficult to put it back.
So the reality is that the dark web is here to stay. That seems like a very good note to draw a line under this episode of The Dark Dive, and sets us up nicely for subsequent episodes where we're going to talk about different areas of the dark web. I'd like to say a big thank you to Gareth and Jim for joining me. If you can't wait to find out more, remember you can follow us for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and whatever podcast app you have on your device, and get one of the episodes now. If you'd like to get in touch with us here at Searchlight Cyber, you can find our social media accounts and email addresses in the show notes. Or you can find plenty of information on our website, www.srcyber.io. But until next time, stay safe.